the network for the AV industry.
What are you listening to?
This
is AV.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Nation.
This is The Lifeline, episode 2, but it's wafer thin. Recorded April 19th, 2012. This episode of The Live Life brought to you by WorldStage, the ultimate resource for event engineering, technology, and imagination. Find us at worldstage.com. And welcome to another edition of The Live Life, the podcast for the event staging and live event community. Today with me I have my co-host, Mike Postapuck. How are you, Mike?
Hello there, and welcome from our nation's capital.
joining us today are some special guests in which we are going to talk about rigging, or hanging, as I'm told it's supposed to be called. Technologies, a few topics about and conversations about the Indiana State Fair findings. That's where the shed came down during a very bad storm and did some very unfortunate things. To discuss this with us today, we have Donald. I'm going to massacre your name, Donald, again.
Guzakis.
Guzakis. He is from HB Group. Also with us is Christian Samuelson, Crosspoint Audiovisual.
Hi there.
Hey. And from Color Tone, we have one Ed Resney.
Hello.
And his associate, Jason Cookland.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, guys. So, Mike, you and I have been talking about this, and both of us sort of read some of the things that John Huntington at his controlgeek.net was writing about some of the Indiana State Fair incident. For those who at the beginning didn't quite know all about what happened, this is where a storm came up and a shed basically came down. I think a lighting guy in the works unfortunately died, and a few people in the audience died as well. And there's been a lot of conversation about this, like pointing fingers left and right, everybody trying to figure out what happened. And a few days ago, there was a live broadcast from the findings of the committee about the Indiana State Fair incident. And while not particularly laying blame, they laid blame. And it wasn't quite clear, really, when they were talking, who they were blaming, other than that there were certain things that they didn't like that were done. And they spent a lot of time talking about the actual collapse, reproducing it, showing in like framework or wirework graphics what failed first and where and why. Mike, I put this to you. Is this something that you guys are afraid of almost every time we do a summer job?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. You know, I tell you, when it comes to rigging, one of my main things are, if you don't know what you're doing, don't do it. You know, hire somebody who knows what they're doing. You know, as far as Indiana, you know, I tell you, I haven't read through everything in there. Obviously, it's like 1,500 pages, the actual report. But, you know, from what I could see in there, it comes down to two main problems in my eyes. One thing is that it's not one thing that causes these problems. It's a bunch of small little things that happen together that causes these big problems. And two is that I think that experience can actually be a double-edged sword. What happens here is you've got a company that's been doing this for 30 years, and so it's good. They know what they're doing. They have a lot of experience. But also that's a problem because they come in there and they say, well, you know, maybe we don't have to exactly do it like this. I've done this 100 times before. It's never been a problem before. And everybody gets a little complacent, and then problems start rolling in. You know, that's really the two biggest things that I could see from there in a big picture sense of the problem there.
So, Ed and Jason, whichever one decides to talk first, just identify yourself. So you guys are the rigging people. Christian, we'll get to you in just a moment. But your take on this, and is there something that we can take away from this that says, yes, we've made some progress and that won't happen again because of X, Y, and Z?
I personally don't do a ton of work with roof systems. It's mainly indoor rigging. But from the stuff that I have done, I've noticed that it's a really complicated thing, including the guy wires and how it's all attached and tied down and stuff. It can have tons of different variables based on tons of different options. We typically, if we're dealing with roof systems, we don't set them up ourselves. We would contract somebody. Just because of the nature of getting the thing inspected on a consistent basis, and they're the ones actually using it every day. But when it comes down to it, in my mind, it's more of the process of getting people out away from the structure when the weather happened. And also there's a little bit of finger pointing in that article, even though I've only gotten through some of it, on exactly the thickness of those guidelines and what they were attached to.
Right. I think the Jersey bars were a problem too, as I understand.
Yep. Yeah, from what I understand, the Jersey barriers were heavy, but they weren't tied down well enough. The cable going to it, which was pretty sure 3/8-inch cable, and the ratchets were also not rated to take the proper weight of each of the guy wires in order to make the thing stable. But just in all those different little variables and all that other stuff going on there, even with that, if there was a good game plan on clearing the area in case of a storm emergency, then it would have still came down, don't get me wrong, but there wouldn't be people up in the follow spot areas, and there also wouldn't be people within 10 feet of the stage.
Yeah, so I'm going to turn this down to Christian. I've heard people talk about this, and I've actually read a few articles where, you know, IATSE guys would say, or rigging guys would say, you know, yeah, there's been more than one occasion where I've had to actually have a couple of the crew stand on top of the Jersey blocks in high winds just to keep these, you know, these things down because they weren't heavy enough to handle the weight. I mean, how do we guarantee that this doesn't, you know, that we know when we go into a venue that it's done right to any fair or even a ballroom for that matter when we're looking at the stuff hanging above us?
Well, fundamentally, if you're a staging company and you're going to hire a company to come in and bring in a stage for you, you want to see that they have a safety plan in place, that they have policies and procedures that they follow, and they will give you rigging documentation that shows the load and the weight-bearing capability of their roof and what it's rated for and what wind capacity. And then they will have an emergency plan that will say at what point do they reach their safety factor and decide that they need to clear the stage, that they need to lower the roof to an acceptable level, that they need to pitch it away from the wind. I worked for a lighting company for a number of years that owned a small, it's like a 20 by 40 foot stage, and it was a crank up, just four crank up towers. And she brought her own weather station, and when it reached 60% of the stage rated tolerance, she would call the show.
Mm. So this is the stage company actually making these decisions, not the the producers of the event.
The producers, the staging company should be the first and foremost decision makers when it is or is not safe to use that stage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that makes sense. Yeah,
their decision should overrule every other decision, you know, on the fairgrounds. I had a full event set up for DC Vote about 5 years ago, and we had a freak windstorm come through DC, and I went back to right in front of the U.S. Capitol, where I had six tents set up, a full stage. Everything was ready to go, and at 11 o'clock at night, the winds hit 60 miles an hour, and I watched my tents tumble like tumbleweeds into the reflecting pool in front of the U.S. Capitol, and there was nothing I could do about it. And we met with the mayor the next morning, and we still had the show, but the roof was tied down, battened down, two Jersey wall and water barricade, 8 feet off the stage, and could go no higher.
I mean, is there a point where, I mean, you basically say this is the most that we could do? I mean, could you have done more to have prevented that? I mean, what if that happened during the day when there were people there? How does that work? I mean, is there just... does it come to a point where this is the most we could do and that's it?
Yeah, I mean, at that point, if those winds had come up while there were people in the area, the Capitol Police would have been informed that there would have, the evacuation plan would have been put into place, and the area would have been cleared completely of people. We had 4 55-gallon drums on each corner of the tent and at each post, because you're not allowed to drive concrete stakes in anywhere on the Capitol lawn. So, you know, if it was lifting up, I was watching these 55-gallon drums get tossed around like they were nothing, full of water. And if wind's got that kind of power, you know, there's nothing that can hold it down. And I would never put a stagehand on a Jersey wall to help hold down a stage. That seems like the most dangerous.
Thing come falling right on you,
Well, it seems like guys will do some strange thing to say, hey, you know, this one's bouncing a little bit. Okay, let's just stand on it for a minute. And then, you know, I know that I've also heard people say that they've jumped out of the way of these things getting blown over because somebody decided to stand next to it. Donald, I come to you because you're sort of in the management side of things as well. And it seems like from this report that there was a lot of finger pointing about which person had the management decision to make the call. And it didn't seem like anyone really felt they had the responsibility or the right to call it.
Well, it all comes down to the planning and the rules that you put into place when you're putting up a system like this. My company doesn't do rigging or roof systems. You know, we refer that to the professionals. But you know, I'm reading some of the stuff in the reports, and some people expressed a desire to cancel the show or bring the roof down, and other people that should not have been involved in that decision process said, oh, it's just rain. We'll play. We'll keep on going. And there needs to be a specific set of criteria that when the wind is at a certain level or the weather forecast is at a certain level or whatever other, you know, variables can be measured, and when they reach those things, a certain a certain thing must be done, a certain action must be taken. And what it seems like is they either didn't have all the measurements and the rules in place, or they decided not to act in accordance with those rules. And that's just dangerous.
So, Jason, I say this to you because you said that you know, you guys were talking about some of the management side as well, and at I think maybe it was Christian, but I'm going to ask you guys anyway. That the staging company or the rigging company probably has the ultimate authority to say yay or nay on almost any incident, right? Even if this is a ballroom, yes, that'll take the load. No, it won't, right? Regardless of what AV people or the facility people want to tell you. Your thoughts on this little indecision that seemed to happen just before the band wanted to go on stage?
I'm not exactly sure what was the main reason for the conflict. From my understanding in the readings, is some people were saying that the band wanted to go on and they were assisting to play. And then they came out with a video saying, no, we did not want to do that. Someone was trying to pass the blame. But when it comes down to it in the outdoor situations, with the stages and stuff, it typically comes down to who owns the stage and who's liable if it falls, and they should make the call, which would be the staging company. They should make the call to bring it down, whether or not you got a producer screaming in your ear, whether or not the band says, we have to go on, we have to go on.
Right.
And in my opinion, personally, the person who is in charge of the staging company should have just said, this thing's coming down, and not even checked with other people. Basically informing other people that it is coming down, but the check procedure at that point in time, which ended up from the initial warning, was about 10 minutes until the stage fell. Checking with people probably took up half, if not all, of that time, to where the point the stage was coming down, where the person knew that the weather was coming, that was part of the staging company. They should have, in my opinion, just started the procedures to bring down the roof and inform people that it was happening, instead of trying to get everyone's side and making it good from everybody to make sure that, oh, okay, this thing can come down. He should have just started the process, sent bodies out, and got everything hooked back up and dropped cable picks in order to drop it.
That makes me wonder, how long does it take to make something safe? Like, when does that decision need to be made? You know, like let's say what you're saying, to make a situation safe, you see it's going to become bad. How long does it take to say, okay, we're safe now? And I guess this would also be in conjunction with moving people away from the stage and things like that also?
Of course, yeah.
That takes some time. So this decision needs to be made early.
Correct. As soon as you hear it.
At the last minute saying, okay, yeah, it's really looking bad now. You know, you really got to make that decision. You got to know actually before you go into the event saying, this is the point where we're going to say, you know, we're going to call it right here. You know, to know what point you're going to call it at before, not trying to make a decision or a judgment, you know, on site at it there.
Donald, do you
Mike, this is Donna. I completely agree with you that the plan needs to be done in advance, and there needs to be criteria for, you know, making changes to the project, and everybody's got to be on board to that. So, you know, as an example, if there is a high wind or a thunderstorm forecast in our area within a certain amount of time from now, we're going to shut it down no matter what. And, you know, I haven't read the report in full, but it appeared that they had some things in place and some criteria in place, but it wasn't fully developed. It wasn't, it didn't go over every potential instance for an outdoor event.
I just want to remind everybody that you are listening to The Live Life, a staging and a live event podcast for AV Nation and Rave Publications. With me today are Donald Guzakis, Mike Postapuck, Christian Samuelson, Ed Resney, and Jason Cookland. And we're discussing some issues around rigging and hanging and stuff like that. And before we finalize this topic, and I'll lay this out to everybody down the line. We'll start with Christian. Where do we get that the safety plan is in place? I mean, we've all talked about somebody's got to be able to shut it down. You've got to be ready to do that. But where am I as the AV supplier or the stage person? I guess really the question is, how often do we come into this conflict? How often do we come into conflicts where the vendor and or the ultimate client, the ballroom owner, the facility, whatever, is fighting with the rigging hardware people about what's safe and what's not?
Well, I mean, that comes up all the time. And fundamentally, when you rent a stage and the staging company will show up, you know, a few days before your event, but you're having planning meetings with your fair producers, your event producers, weeks in advance. So what you need to do is to get the engineering data and the information that they have on their safety plans and procedures and bring that material to those meetings. And that way, in conjunction with the other people that sit on those meetings, typically I've sat in on meetings where there was police, EMS, the fair producer, the event producer, and other people related to the safety of the event, where those safety procedures were gone over, not just for the stage, but for all other scenarios as well. As to, like, rigging situations in ballrooms, you will find facilities people that say, it's okay to hang there. Everybody hangs on that point. And you take one look at that and say, that's low steel. I'm not hanging from that. Or, you know, I can't imagine that could possibly be a rigging point, and there's no way that I'm going to put anything on that point. I'll bridle off somewhere else. You know, and that comes down to professional experience as well. But if you have the hotel guy give you an engineering document that shows that a structural engineer has certified that point for X number of pounds, you can hang on that. And as long as it comes crashing down with that piece of steel attached to it, you're in the clear.
Not that you want that to happen, but yes. That
right.
Jason, I asked that of you, and then I'll go to Donald and Mike. I mean, do you guys have to fight this, or is there some kind of contractual establishment that says we're not going to fight about this, we're in command, period?
When it comes to the hotels, and it's a little bit different of a story than the stage roofs. Typically, you find in-house rigging companies at a lot of the hotels nowadays, and generically, they actually do have the engineering documents where they can just pull it out and say this is rated for that. And as long as you've got an engineer or a certified engineering diagram saying that you can hang there and that it's rated for this weight, as long as that's pretty current. I have been in some scenarios where I've got 100-year-old blueprints with stuff. As long as the building's not too old or the actual engineering document isn't out of date, I would personally hang there. And as he was saying, if the steel comes down and they have the engineering documents and they are the technical in-house riggers, it is their liability. Just because I've also done work in a lot of tents where in the tents you're not dealing with someone rigging, but as the stage roofs, every tent has an engineering document that says each ridge is rated for a live load at the ridge and halfway down each beam of the ridge. And in those sort of situations, I've taken into question a couple times if the proper support cables were installed into the tent and stuff like that, even though I know technically that's the tent company's responsibility. I've been able to get in contact with engineers and other different people of who actually make the tents, who install the points, even up to the point where I talked to some structural engineers, and they give you certified documents saying...
Michael Marcel, are you here somewhere?
Saying that...
It's right there.
In a moment.
Saying that they took into account the age of the building or the age of the structure, and it's been consistently certified. And in those types of situations, I have... It's been hard to find the information, but it is stuff you can find, especially with tent companies. You typically have to call the tent manufacturer. The tent companies really, if they have the documents, you luck out. But most of the time, you have to get all the way up to get a certified load rating. You have to follow the chain of tents or roofs or in the ballrooms, let's say, I would typically follow the general ideas of the riggers. But then, of course, you always meet the people that have gotten thrown into the position and don't know exactly what they're talking about, even if they're looking directly at the engineering document, because sometimes it's based on straight dead hangs. And if that's the case, it's pretty simple. But when you get into the bridling and coming off of multiple points, then it goes a little bit more in depth, which some people who might have gotten thrown into the position might not know or might not have the ability to figure out what the actual loads are going to be. And in that case, then I would be hesitant. But typically when I see an engineering document and a specific load rating, I'm pretty comfortable. But then on the other hand, I do know that with the whole fair thing, the supposed roof structure was rated for 64 miles an hour wind rating, which there's a formula to calculate wind rating on a structure. And when they do the test after the fact and they find out that the thing's going to fall at 30 miles an hour instead of 64, that sometimes makes you also question the engineering reports and stuff like that.
So, Christian, I'll ask you this of you, because Jason was basically saying, hey, you know, we look at the engineering reports. Yes, we do a little look over and we make sure that what we think is in the drawings is the same thing. But how much time do you guys or does your crew spend looking at the physical connections, as it were, in relationship to the drawings to say, yes, this is what it says. And yes, I've looked at them. They're good. Or is it really just trusting that the building says yes?
Well, I mean, a lot of times there's a certain trust factor involved. You get into, you know, brand new buildings like the Gaylord here in D.C. or some of the Disney properties down in Orlando, and they've got hard points every 8 feet in the ceiling that you can trust. The building is less than 10 years old. You know you're flying a light load, and it's not a second guess. You know, if you're flying a full speaker array, you may want to take a second look at one of those points. But for 90% of the shows that we do in corporate AV, we're not hanging more than, you know, on a downstage truss more than a few thousand pounds at best, spread across 3 points. It gives us a safety factor typically of better than 15 or 20 to 1, which is, you know, ridiculously high for what some of those points are rated for that are installed by these buildings. Now, if you go into, like, if you're taking a little touring rock and roll rig into a theater, and you're going to be flying off of some of their batten systems for whatever reason, an old fly rail system, you certainly want to have a much closer look at those scenarios. You know, that can get really dicey really fast because of the complications involved in a single or double purchase fly system. A lot of times they will go directly to the grid in various points, and that grid is meant to hold up a person on top of a grid, not a rigging point, where they should be rigging to I-beams or bridling off I-beams in that fly system if they are going to be hanging motors.
So, Donald, I'll ask this to you, since you know, you're in the management side again, and you're looking at this stuff. When you go into a building, you've already obviously either contracted with or agreed with the in-house people what's being hung where, and you're trusting them. But how do you look at what's provided to you about, say, what the lighting's going to be hung on, or some of the speaker arrays are going to be hung on? Are you looking that over, or your crew looking that over physically, say, more than just, I know that this will spread the audio out properly? Or are you guys really taking a second glance at what someone's saying will be hung and how it's going to be hung?
Well, it boils down to the documentation and certification. So if it's well documented, well organized, it's got tags and inspection dates, then you can trust it. And if they're disorganized, or there's no inspections, or there's really no information, that's when you really start to question things. We work in a facility where the roof itself bows. It's an old wood beam structure, and occasionally they want us to rig things from that, and we know that it'll handle a certain amount of weight, but if it's either raining or has snowed, we immediately discount that, and we'll only go ground support only because of what we know about the facility. But you don't always have that luxury. It boils down to whether they can prove what they're telling you, and then the professionals step in and validate that as well.
Do you have someone on staff who knows enough about that, maybe that's you, to at least say, yes, I've taken that, you know, hour-long look at this, and yes, according to my authority, this what they're saying is right?
Yes, I have somebody here that does my general lighting design. He's not certified, but he understands the math and the safety factors and the general design of rigging. So if somebody says you can do this, and he does the math and say, you know, hey, we're only at you know, 10 to 1, I won't do that, they'll work on it. So yes, I do.
And Mike?
Yeah, you know, I would have to say my first thought is... I would have to say my first stop is the venue. I mean, normally if I'm doing something where I actually have to hang rigging and stuff, it's not going to be in some small, you know, rinky-dink place that's falling apart. It's usually in a bigger venue, and normally actually in those bigger venues, the venues require that you use their rigging company. And so it is a lot of trust. And but being that it is a company that the venue uses and it's their responsibility, you can be pretty sure that they're going to be on top of it, because it's their reputation on the line there. So yeah, and then, you know, when I have the actual, you know, technicians and, you know, your lighting guys and your things like that, they could see something if something's out of whack, obviously. But But yeah, I mean, it comes down to trust a lot for me.
And Donald, something I was thinking about as Mike was talking, he's like, you talked about the wood beam and sometimes it bows and in certain weather you don't use it. How do you tell? I mean, is it just when it just rained and do you let it dry out? Is there some kind of way of telling how bowed the roof is? I'm just curious. It's sort of like using a sail or a mast that may bend too much in certain wind. I'm not quite sure how that works.
Well, it's a venue that we've been working here in Connecticut for a very, very long time. And I know the owners of the facility, and it's just experience. We just know when we're working in there what the limitations of it are.
It was just interesting because we just did a show. One of our shows on Aviation is called DIY, and we did something about instrument makers who, you know, do guitars and violins from scratch. And one of the things they talked about is knowing when the wood would bend and reading how it would form. It's sort of like the sculptor saying, you know, hey, I know what's in that stone. The stone is telling me what to carve. I just thought it was a very interesting take on that.
Yeah, it's an art. I do want to say something about Mike's comment with regards to the in-house rigging companies. Because many, many of them are really, really great guys that know their stuff. And many of them are AV technicians that should not be touching rigging equipment in any way, shape, or form.
In major venues, you see that, you think?
Yeah.
It depends on the venue. You know, we're a relatively small company, so we don't work in a lot of big venues. I'm talking about some of the corporate facilities, ballrooms, maybe a theater or a smaller conference center, where they don't have a certified rigger. They don't necessarily maintain the points or get them certified on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of taking them at their word. And, in some cases, they're suggesting that we do what could be perceived as dangerous things. Because it doesn't pass that, 12-to-1 safety factor or even common sense.
Well, I tell you, I don't do much rigging, but you really give me some pause now for some future stuff. In the past, it just seems that and most of the rigging that's done, it's in newer facilities and stuff. So I still feel good, but if you're telling me that you're maybe not brand new facilities or less than gigantic corporation type facilities may actually be a problem. That seems that's news to me, because I tell you, it's that's scary that somebody would allow that when they're when they have all that responsibility. That just I can't understand that.
Christian, you wanted to jump in at a point here.
Oh, well, I mean, you see all the time AV people acting as riggers in some of these facilities where the in-house rigger rule is enforced, and you can spot a new one a mile away. If you've got a downrigger that's not looking up and watching his rigger, if you've got that down guy standing directly under the load that the rigger is hanging, that's a dangerous situation, because it just screams inexperience and danger. And I've seen people get clobbered but dropping pins and shackles, and they were standing right there, accidents that could have been prevented. And it was, you're putting your rig's fate into the hands of someone who may not be experienced, but because it's the house rigging company, it's the only and most expensive option that you have.
Mm. Jason.
I've actually run into a couple of different situations with the hotel rigging staff. I have noticed a lot when you do have these AV guys that get put up in charge. And I've even seen to the point where they go out and they get the certification and they still have no idea what's going on, they have the generic idea what the math is, but as the whole concept of rigging goes, it doesn't seem like these guys know what's going on at all. I've even run into the point of where these guys, particularly actually, since somebody mentioned a Disney facility, there was a Disney facility I was working at down in Orlando First of all, the rigging company, I've worked with them multiple times. They hang all their truss from the top cords, which I 100% don't believe is the right thing to do. But and when I asked them about it, first of all, I made them change it. But when I asked them about it, they said, well, Jim, the truss manufacturer basically said, hey, you can do it. Whereas in my experience, I won't hang from the top cords of a truss unless I'm using pick points of some sort. I've also run into people down in the same facility where they do have the installed points in the ceiling, and basically they just are big, humongous eye bolts that thread up in there. And I saw one of the riggers up in the air struggling with it, trying to get it to twist into the hole. And basically, as soon as I saw that, I told him to move the point, and he asked me why. And I said, you're struggling to get that in there. You're probably cross-threading the eye bolt, for all I know. Mm. And I ended up getting a really big attitude with me, but short end of the story is we moved where the truss was and added points in different spots in order to make it work.
So that leads me to a silly question. Again, as I said at the beginning, I'm in the staging world, but I'm not by any person, a hanging person or a rigging person. But why not from the top of it? Is it similar to... I know the manufacturer, you said that they could do it, but like in the projection world, we have projection manufacturers say, sure, you can stand that thing on its side, but we all know that mm-hmm. you do it for more than 30 minutes and it's going to blow that light engine bulb and destroy the entire innards. So Jason, why would you not hang it from there? Was there a short answer?
Me personally, not grabbing all four cords of the truss and supporting it that way, you're basically pulling your whole load from the top two cords. And just in my common sense standpoint is if I had a choice between holding two things and holding four things in order to support something, I would, of course, want to be grabbing the entire stick of truss versus half of it.
Okay, that makes sense. Go ahead,
Can I ask a question about certification here? I mean, did I hear earlier that you were saying that there are certified people that actually do very shoddy work?
I have run into a couple, yes.
I mean, what is the problem here? Is it that the testing is not stringent enough, or these people just don't care? I mean, that's bad.
It's practical experience, too. You know, you can go and take a test. You can study for a test. You can learn how to take apart a car engine, but unless you've done it, you're not going to do it correctly. And I'm not Estes certified. I took classes in fall arrest and rigging from Rocky Paulson and a guy named Ty Knotts years and years ago at LDI before ESTA had certifications. But now that they do offer it for anybody who's, you know, younger than 30 years old, I think it's a really good idea to have that. But also, if you're hiring a rigger for your show or for your production company, you know, you want to talk to some of his coworkers, possibly former employers, and get to know that guy. And, you know, you can be the smartest person at the world in your bridal math and doing the formulas and calculations, but unless you've got a good head on your shoulders, you know, mistakes are going to happen.
That's a great point. And I'll tell you, you know, so, I mean, in essence, we're saying that, you know, I go ahead and I hire a certified person, I shouldn't just say, okay, we're good now. I got to really dig a lot deeper than just, okay, that's kind of like just a starting point maybe, is okay, I've got a certified person here, and I got to really dig deeper to make sure that this is good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you're going to hire somebody, you definitely want to look a little deeper than saying somebody's certification card from ESTA to know that they've taken and passed the test.
For one second, guys, I just want to remind the folks that they are listening to The Live Life, the event staging and live event podcast for Aviation and Rave Pubs. So, Jason, Christian was just talking about some of that, about certification, about ESTA and which ones. But is there more than one certification? Is there one that applies to specific type of jobs? Or, you know, are we looking at more? And how do, and as the conversation was going on, how do we know that ESTA certified or whatever certified person, how do you guys know that they do what they are supposed to do? or know it?
There is two certifications. There is the arena certification, and then there is the theater certification done by ETCP, which is Esther Plaza. They've been bumping around a lot now, but I personally, I'm not ETC certified or ETCP certified in being a rigger, but I've been doing rigging now for a little over 8 years. I've also done the classes. I haven't done it with Rocky Paulson. I did it with Bill Sapsis. I've gone through full motor training, and I've been working with a rigger that's been doing it for well over 30 years of nothing but rigging. Unfortunately, that person no longer works with us now. It's all me. But having somebody that knows what they're doing on top of the experiences they had, also with a mix of good education. Basically, in my opinion, almost anyone can just pass a test just to pass a test. But when it comes down to it, you have to really know what you're doing when you jump into it. I personally, though, I think, yes, for the younger people, it's a good benchmark to know that people are certified. But I don't think that should ever be just the only thing you look at when you're talking to hiring a rigging company, working with a rigging company. Stuff like that, basically, is you need to go over all the facts and figures. You got to make sure these guys have done it. They've worked with professionals. The education is a big part of it, but it's not everything. There's been riggers for years and years and years, and certification just came out. So,
well, how old is the certification? Let's ask that question. Donald, I know you were mentioning something to me on the chat here about ESTA and stuff. I mean, how old is certification to our knowledge? When did it really become official beyond, say, the apprenticeship method that seems to be discussed here?
All right, so the official ETCP certification came out in 2007. And as of right now, per my ETCP search, there's about 1,000 certified riggers in the U.S. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, guys that just can take a test well. There's actually some pretty stringent requirements for them just to be able to apply. So I know that in the past, we relied on things like a certificate program. It wasn't an actual certification, but a certificate program that was offered by, you know, Rocky and some other companies. And they were really good programs, but they didn't address the experience issue where the technician could go for that course. And if they could demonstrate that they understood the math and the essentials, then they could get that certificate. And then they would go on and possibly continue to develop bad habits because they didn't have a really in-depth training and certification. So, you know, I don't want to blow this out of proportion because in many cases there's some non-certified technicians that are really, really good. They have a thorough understanding of the venue, of design, of safety, and they work really well. And then on the other hand, there's some people that are, you know, carry certificates, probably not the certified guys from the ETCP, but that are a danger and need to be watched because they have some bad habits, or maybe they had a long call yesterday and they're just tired, so they're looking for a shortcut.
Well, I put this to you, Christian. We're saying that so what I'm hearing from Donald and I'm inferring from Jason is that true industry certification is a relatively new thing. And it seems like there was an apprenticeship sort of mode, which is actually quite valuable in my estimation. But are we missing something?
Well, what are you talking about? Like, as in a step between taking a test and apprentice, or how that works hand in hand, or where are you going?
Yeah, well, because I mean, it seems like it's so new, which shocks me.
Well, you know, there are some, you know, recently there are entertainment schools, technician schools, where you can go and be a technician. And, you know, those kids think that they're going to be, you know, front of house sound engineer for Linkin Park right out of the gate. They don't realize that, you know, our first 5-10 years was a lot of pushing boxes and a lot of loading trucks and a lot of going to get coffee for the LD or the head rigger, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And that's all those dues that you pay. And, you know, you develop a network of professionals and people that you know and trust. And when you travel and tour, there's people that you know and trust around the country. And when you get to a place, if you question somebody, you go to your guy, your local guy, and say, hey, what about that dude? You know, I learn something new every place I go, every venue I walk into. You know, some LD or somebody will teach me a tip on a whole hog or something that I didn't know before. Beware of the rigger or the guy who knows it all, who's the expert, who doesn't want your ideas or opinions, because that's a dangerous guy. You know, when we stop learning, when we stop growing, when we stop taking advice or suggestions or take offense to somebody trying to offer those things, you know, that's when we need to pull back a little bit and say, you know, maybe this guy isn't the right guy for the job.
Amen.
Can I ask a question? That kind of brings a question to mind here.
Go, Mike.
Let me ask you guys, does rigging techniques change over time? Like, is there better technique? I guess equipment gets different and better, but like, do the techniques change, or like, are they always the same and been the same since,
Mike,
the beginning?
The last time I checked, gravity was constant.
I don't know. Einstein might have something to say about that in some ways, but that's getting a little nitpicky, right?
Well, I can't change the laws of physics.
If it wasn't for those laws of physics, we'd be able to do anything, right?
It comes down to nuts, bolts, chains, shackles, and truss, and those things don't change that much.
So, I mean, does a person who's certified need to get recertified all the time? You know, do you have to, like, get continuing education to stay up on things? Or do you think, like, once you're certified, you're pretty good to go?
But if you don't do it for a while, you're going to get rusty like anything else. You know, you can't take the test, pass it, and then 10 years later decide you're going to hang an arena show and be successful at it.
Every 5 years with the ETCP certification, you have to recertify. And in order to recertify, you have to have a certain amount of credits, either based on hours or based on continuing education. In order to allow you to recertify it after 5 years.
Interesting. I do like the apprentice aspect of it, though. I mean, it's something that I've always believed in any field, and this especially. Although, I've always assumed that there was, you know, some sort of magic paper that said, you know, yes, before you can walk in this building, you need to have this little, you know, thing stamped on you, or the tattooed emblazoned that says the following. So let's talk a little bit. Actually, there's one question I want to ask, because I forget who it was, and I think it was Christian who corrected me in saying that
yes.
It's not rigging, it's hanging people.
That
so
was
is there
hanging
difference?
Americans, I believe it hanging actually was.
Well, is there a difference?
No, that was just a joke.
Oh, okay.
The joke was, you know, we don't like to be called riggers anymore. We like to be called hanging Americans.
Okay.
I've heard that from one side of the country to the other, and it's just a joke that the rigger will tell you when you walk into the venue.
Is this sort of akin to the Boy Scout left-handed smoke shifter? Go find it. No, was I the only one that had that happen to? Well, you know, being left-handed, it happens. Everything's left-handed to me. Come on. So when. Let's bring this back to, say, the general AV guy. You know, there's an AV companies. There's lots of them. And when I first entered the staging and event staging world, I came from doing rentals and from doing recording studios, right? So I always thought that it was this little small microcosm, and then soon learned, only years later actually, that there were lots of mom and pop shops. There was lots of work going out to some of these smaller shops, and they're not going to be quite aware of exactly what this terminology is. So my question is going to be twofold, but the first, and I'll bring this to Jason. For a neophyte like me, is there a book I can get? Is there some place I can go? Is there a website that you guys suggest that says you want to understand at least the nomenclature or the terminology going on and some of the basic concepts? Where's the best place to start? Is it Plaza or is it Riggers R Us or something of that nature?
I personally went out and got a bunch of books. There's one particular book that pretty well seemed to have everything in it. It's called Entertainment Rigging. It's by Harry Donovan. And it's a really thorough book that goes really in-depth into a lot of the different aspects of rigging. I also am in purchasing that book. I picked up a stage rigging book. Which was more of the counterweight batten systems, but there's a ton of information out there on rigging. Me personally, though, I mix it up with some of those books. I have taken a lot of the classes for rigging, everything from just the rigging math class at LDI to a couple of classes with Bill Sapsis, and really, the main thing that I based everything off of was from what the person who had done it for 30 years had told me. I mixed it up with the information from the book, and I kind of had to come up with my own opinion on exactly which way and how I would do certain things in order to make it work and still be safe and all that kind of stuff. But that particular book, the first one I mentioned, really goes in depth into a lot of the aspects of from this is a shackle to this is a basket to how you attach the truss, how you're supposed to properly put the, if you're not using gag flex span sets, how to properly attach the steel to the truss. It goes really in depth in that book, and that was kind of one of my big starting points from the education process, other than doing it and working with somebody who's been doing it for a long, long period of time.
Cool. I'll actually probably email you guys and say, hey, can you send me that link? So we'll put it on the show notes when we post links for that. Christian?
I got a degree in technical theater design and production. And my background started out in theatrical rigging. And then when I got out of school, a few years after school, I did a lot of work at the Atlanta Olympics and got my my IA card down there in Atlanta, and I was rigging with really experienced riggers, down rigging for them and doing some up steel in ballrooms to start out. So I got a lot of like early experience. One of the really seasoned guys made me walk on a 2x4 across a curb, back and forth for a half an hour without falling off before he would take me up into the air.
And that was
before we had to wear safety equipment and there was lanyards and dual tie-off points and in the Omni to get a bridle around one of the support beams, you had to lay on it and sling your body halfway around, sling the steel underneath, slide over the other side and grab it. And, you know, it was dangerous and scary, and now they don't do any of those things. It's a much safer, sane world. And it does change depending on what you're rigging in, where you rig at. Now I do a lot of permanent installation, and the criteria that I need to meet for an architect or a structural engineer is different from what we do for live entertainment as far as safety ratings and methodology and what's plenum and what's not plenum. And you know, when I put together a rigging system for a client, I can demonstrate a safety factor to their specification down to the lowest common denominator of the smallest piece of hardware in the entire chain, from the load to the structure. And that's what they want to see. And with that sort of documentation, you know, you can tell them that the building will fall down and my speakers will still be hanging there in midair.
I actually think I've seen some of that happen. I think I've seen pictures of like these structures that were burnt down or just come collapsing, and there are the, you know, the truss is still standing.
Oh dear!
I know what I'm actually surprised at, Chris. As you were talking about the 2x4 walking across, I'm surprised that they didn't make you touch your nose with your fingertips as you walk back and forth to truly prove it. Because I was listening to was it NPR did something about the steel guys in the towers, about how that's basically how they do it I think it's, I can't remember which tribe it is up in New York.
Right, that Indian tribe. They built like half of Manhattan for crying out loud.
Yeah, the Native American guys, who that's their tradition, and they were talking about how they did that. Like the kids will be climbing up on fake steel that's only a couple feet high, but you know, running around and lifting things up and down on it, because that's just, you know, it's a matter of pride of being able to supply people and to do this. But interesting, Donald, you had some thoughts on that, on like for us staging guys to get a better handle on this.
Well, you know, it's about being educated, at least on the essentials. So there's some classes out there. If you're not the kind of person that can get some practical experience while you're reading the book, then you really need to get into a classroom where you can ask questions and interact with people. And LDI is a fall trade show that features a lot of rigging hardware, and they also have their institute. And they offer some classes specific to the introduction to rigging. So for people that need to understand about it but probably not be the lead rigger, you can go to the courses, get a basic understanding of the math, the safety factors, the how to check some of the things for safety. And then when you get out to a show site, and you see something that doesn't look quite right, at least you'll understand what it means. And you'll be able to talk about things like the safety factors and have probably a little bit more intelligent conversation. So there's things that you know, there's things that you don't know, but then it's trying to understand what you don't know that it can get you into trouble.
I'm glad you pulled that out. I thought you were going to go into a Rumsfeld there on me for a moment. We can only know the unknown that's not known. Wait, what?
I don't know.
I don't know. Exactly the answer it should have been. We don't know, but we're trying. Oh, my goodness. All right, so here's one for the us staging guys, for the normal us videots and audio guys who do little of this. What's the most common mistake or misconception that you guys have seen about this that needs to be corrected? Something that you know you've bickered with or had to pull the authority of, you know, I'm the rigger person, don't tell me that I know what I'm doing, that we as vidiots and audio guys have done or presume is correct. Jason, I'll start with you.
I've had a lot of times in the past where people will just add and keep adding gear based on what the client asked for, what the client's needs are at the time. We're going to add some 12 more lights to light up this area and this, that, and the other. And it gets to the point where I have to go through, double check my math every single time they do that sort of thing. And it sometimes occasionally gets to the point where you have to add a point in or two, or add in another truss or ground support it, because they don't personally think when they're going into and adding a light into a show or throwing some more speakers in it, that a lot of people don't take into account on how much weight that's actually adding up. And that's why when I personally do any sort of rigging whatsoever, is I'll do my math to basically go ahead and calculate what it's going to be. But then if stuff changes, which happens on a pretty consistent basis, at least with us.
No way. Live events, there's no changes. Never.
As soon as I'm about to go out the door, I double check with the audio guy, the video guys, the guy that's doing the lights, and just go ahead and get 100% double check on exactly what they're putting on the trusses, where, how it's going to distribute, stuff like that. I also know that we have a, because we do a significant amount of tent rigging. We do make sure that when we go and we say, hey, we ideally we'd like to rig in this tent. We're going to do a truss down the spine and a couple other little trusses. Every single tent is different. Every single tent manufacturer is different. And I personally have come into a situation where we were doing the rigging, but other people were hanging stuff off of it, another lighting company. And they came in and this is not to my knowledge, but they had talked and did the site survey, checking out the tent with the event producer that was working on the show. And they said, oh, you can hang there. And ended up, it was a purlin inside of the tent. And it took me a good hour with two crews doing nothing but consistently complaining that we're not getting any work done. I had to get a hold of the tent manufacturer and find out where I could hang from. But it's a common misconception I found, at least within tents, that people just think that you can kind of hang anywhere on pretty much anything and it's not a whole ton of weight. But as soon as I hear the word tent, I kind of cringe a little bit. It's kind of a pain in the butt to get information out of people, on top of sometimes people want you to keep your cable picks clean, so they'll ask you to tie it up. Me personally, I do the same thing as if I was part of a roof system setup, is I make sure everything can come down almost with the hit of a button.
So what you're saying is essentially a lot of us videots and audio guys say, well, but it's just wafer thin. It'll be fine.
Yeah, it's just a projector. It's just two speakers. But then when you get down to it, I've run to the point where I'm like, you got to take down those two lights and that speaker. This thing's not going up, you know?
Yeah, so I'd like to throw in one thing that I see time and time again, and early on I was told that my lighting truss was ready for me to hang on, and I turn around and it looks like a smiley face and nothing's hung on, and I went over and checked and none of the bolts were tight.
Wow!
And I see this time and time again where truss bolts, it's put together by the AV guys, somebody's supposed to come behind and tighten them, they don't, there's a bolt missing, there's something not there, and that's a very dangerous situation, and it's on my mental checklist to do before I hang a light on a truss, is to go through and just check finger tight, make sure that those truss bolts are tight. And, you know, the other thing that I think that would help the industry as a whole is if every technician on their very first day was taught how to tie a bowline and a clove hitch.
There you go. I was just about to say, I was going to come up with a catchphrase where you're saying that NASA has a checklist, so should we. It's both life safety issues. And yes, that's cool. I should re-study my knots, you know? Boy Scouts, I should do it. Mike?
Yeah, one of the things that I would just like to hear, get your guys' opinion on is, I would like to know, you know, let's say, okay, I go ahead and I read up a little bit about, you know, a little more about rigging and learn a little bit more about it, but I am not going to go out and do it every day, so I'm not going to become good at it. So what do I need to do? What things can I use that I can say to myself, you know, I feel comfortable about hiring this company and bringing them in? What things should I look for? The certification, recommendations from industry people, you know, what would you suggest that I look for that would make me feel comfortable?
You know, I'll start with Donald. Donald, what do you look for?
So they're going to ask good questions. And this is in no particular order. They're definitively going to come recommended by somebody that you trust. They are going to have the proper insurance. And be damn proud of it.
Now, does that insurance change state by state, or is there a general insurance that we should look for?
I believe that all insurance regulations vary by state by state, but they're going to have a good liability policy. They're going to have, you know, good workman's comp. You know, the things that you would do when you're hiring any good subcontractor. And they're not going to fight you on it or hide it. They're going to have those certificates, and they're going to be proud of them, because if they're dangerous, they won't be insurable. And they're going to communicate well with you and make you comfortable.
Interesting. Christian?
I'd like to just, I think some really valid points were made about reputation and, you know, asking about, you know, in your town who you know and who you trust, and, you know, word gets around quickly if you're not supposed to use somebody or shouldn't use somebody for whatever reason or accident or insecurities. But I know that traveling out of town, that is, you know, certainly a different ball of wax, and calling around to some of the local companies and getting opinions. Like if you're going to be renting lights locally in a foreign venue or a distant city, you know, you want to ask them who they normally use. I mean, it's nice to partner up companies that work together on a consistent basis and know each other and like each other and get along and communicate well. Something to be said for that also.
Jason?
Personally, yeah, having a good, solid game plan on how they are going to interpret the rigging in many different situations is something I would consistently look for. I would also talk to them kind of about their motors, when's the last time they've been inspected. Yeah. Me personally, I know that when I get my motors, I'm doing the motor inspection myself. I go through a 30-point checklist, completely disassemble the motor. I check brake gaps. I go through every little piece of that motor where I've talked to a lot of different rigging companies. Well, they'll take it out, throw the 150% of the load rating on it and call it a day. When I hear that, those motors that are just taking the weight and not getting fully gone through are more of an industrial rigging company in my mind. That's the one thing I've noticed is a lot of the industrial people are trying to pick up work from the entertainment people. There's companies in my town who have taken motors to companies that say, oh, we can certify these for entertainment purposes. Then they find out a year later they threw some weight on it and slapped it back out the door and didn't do anything. So I typically try to find out how long and how often they do maintenance on their gear, how long they would go ahead and do they check to see if their steel's been stretched with micrometers. I personally, just because I have a really good understanding of it, if I'm talking to somebody about having them do rigging for me, I try to go in depth on as many possible items and issues that could pop up and how their certification processes go and how regularly do they check for kinks and bends and stretch steels and some sort of stuff like that.
Cool. Well, guys, I want to thank you. It was a really interesting show. I want to thank you guys a lot for coming on. With us today was Donald Guzakis. He is from HB Group. He can be reached at hbgroupinc.com. Mike Postapuk, he is at AV Mike P? Yeah,
yes.
AV Mike P or Perspective. That's Perspective AV. Christian Samuelson, he's from Crosspoint Audiovisual. And I've forgotten, I didn't write it down. Christian, just give me your company name.
It's Crosspoint AV, spelled with an X.
All right. And you can be reached best at?
CrosspointAV.com. You can find my email.
Cool. And also with us was Jason Cookland, and he can be reached or via his associate, Ed at Colortone. Thank you, gentlemen, so much. And we will talk to you guys again soon. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
This episode of The Live Life brought to you by WorldStage, the ultimate resource for event engineering, technology, and imagination. Find us at worldstage.com.